From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Tens of millions of Americans are casting their ballots through various means, including mail-in voting and early in-person voting, eager to have their say in the most important election of our lifetimes. But the GOP, seeing the enthusiasm among Democrats in particular, are readying a political fight that is part of what my guest calls the Republican plot for permanent minority rule. David Daley is a journalist whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Slate, The Washington Post, and New York Magazine. He's a senior fellow at Fair Vote, former editor of Salon, and his books include Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, and Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. His newly published article is in The New Republic, and it's called Inside the Republican Plot for Permanent Minority Rule. Welcome to the program, David.
Thanks again for having me.
So the premise of your piece seems to be that there was a time when both Republicans and Democrats were fairly in agreement on the importance of increasing voting access to all Americans. Obviously, we've had a very troubled history around access to the ballot. We have the 1965 signing of the Voting Rights Act, and you point out as recently as a few years ago, there were top Republican leaders working to ensure the Voting Rights Act was being met to its fullest potential. So what was that time like? And what happened?
I'm glad you started there because you're absolutely right. We have a long and troubled history of unequal access to the ballot in this nation. But what I would say is that in 2006, the Voting Rights Act is reauthorized by Congress, a Republican Congress, nearly unanimously and signed into law for another 25 years by a Republican president in George W. Bush. And the story of how that happened is kind of fascinating. You have a Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Congressman Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, and he realizes that he's about to be term limited out as chair of that powerful committee in the House. And he looks over his shoulder and he realizes that there is a Texas conservative firebrand next in line who is not a supporter of the Voting Rights Act. So Sensenbrenner reaches across the aisle. He calls up John Conyers. He calls up Mel Watt, two leaders in the Congressional Black Caucus on the Democratic side. And he says, let's get this done now. And they build a record. They build a 12,000-page record of why the Voting Rights Act is still crucial in 2005. And they collect examples from across the nation of redistricting schemes and precinct closures and annexation and attempts to dilute the vote of minority communities. And they move through nearly unanimously. And it feels like a fever dream to imagine that moment could be back in our politics.
So we have had you on our program many times to talk about one of your specialties, which is the Republican, mostly Republican gerrymandering efforts across the country. And that seems to be one of a multi-pronged, very deliberate, long-term approach by the Republican Party to now restrict voting rights, because they see that their policies are backed by a minority of Americans?
I think that's exactly right. I think what happens not long after the Voting Rights Act is reauthorized is you have the election of Barack Obama, and you have this rising coalition of a changing America. And you see states across the South begin to tip from red to blue. And it's a huge Democratic year. There's a supermajority in the U.S. Senate of Democrats in 2008. And the response by Republicans is to understand that as historic a year as 2008 was, 2010 had the ability to be that much more consequential because it was a redistricting year. It was a census year. And whoever controlled state legislatures around the country would be in charge of drawing all of the new lines, not only for all of those state legislatures, but also for the congressional districts in most states. And they recognized this as sort of an inexpensive path back to power. They spend about $30 million in 2010 on trying to flip 107 state legislative seats across 16 states. We're talking about Florida and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, North Carolina, states we keep coming back to over the course of this decade, right? States that tipped the Electoral College to Donald Trump in 2016, states where for this entire decade, even when Democrats win more votes for state legislature or for Congress in those states, Republicans have maintained control. Those maps have worked. They've locked in an enduring form of minority rule for about 50 million Americans in those states.
So do we also need to account for the fact that the Supreme Court weakened the Voting Rights Act just a few years ago, and we are on the verge of a decades-long conservative supermajority?
I think that's the next piece of the story. So after those new lines are drawn in 2011, you have the Supreme Court decision, a 5-4 decision authored by John Roberts in 2013 in Shelby County versus Holder. And this is the decision that really guts Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. This is the key preclearance clause that had forced localities who had had a history of racism in their voting to bring any changes before either the Department of Justice or a federal court in Washington, D.C. And John Roberts says in his opinion that it's not 1965 anymore and that the South has changed and that we no longer needed preclearance. Well, the very afternoon that this decision comes down, the state of Texas puts into effect one of the most far-reaching voter ID bills in the country that essentially cuts off access to the polls for 600 Latino voters in Texas who were registered but lacked the necessary ID. This is the same bill that made it possible to vote in Texas with a gun license but not a student ID. In North Carolina, they had two voter suppression bills ready. They had a skinny one, about 10 pages of voter IDs and other provisions in case the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Voting Rights Act. But as soon as they knocked out Section 5, they moved what they called the monster suppression bill, about 57 pages, one of the toughest voter ID bills in the country, a cut to the number of days of early voting. They ended pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds. They tightened up absentee ballot restrictions. And you saw this across the entire country. John Roberts said the country had changed. Instead, what happened is in state after state, you see voter ID bills passed and voter roll purges and precinct closures. And it really put the lie to this decision that is one of the absolute voting rights disasters of this decade.
I remember covering the Supreme Court decision, this decision that it arrived at unsolicited, decided on its own to, you know, this body of appointed justices decided on its own to do this. And I remember thinking, what will the future hold? Here we are in 2020. So the stage is now set where the Republicans have painstakingly, with the enabling of the Supreme Court, set into motion a situation where a president who did not have a majority mandate, who is in power with 3 million fewer votes than his candidate, is seeking re-election. In 2020, a lot of people are talking not necessarily as much about what happened in 2016, but what happened in 2000 with Bush v. Gore. And that's where you start your piece as well. What is the scenario, the worst case scenario that you imagine could take place November 3rd or very soon after this year?
I think the trouble comes if this election is close, if this election is decided by some of these swing states that have been gerrymandered under Republican control and that have already demonstrated over the course of this decade that they will do anything to hold on to power. We've seen the lame duck power grabs in North Carolina and Wisconsin when those states elected Democratic governors. So imagine that the president of the United States goes on TV and declares victory off of incomplete results from states like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, these gerrymandered states that are going to have to process millions and millions of mail ballots, and those gerrymandered legislatures under control of Republicans who have been told for months now that they need to start processing those ballots, opening them, checking them, verifying signatures, beginning the process of tabulation. They need to join the more than 40 other states that allow their election officials to start this process early. And instead, they have fought that every step of the way. Michigan finally just gave election officials an extra 10 hours to process what could be 2.1 million additional votes that they say will take weeks. We could be heading towards the kind of uncharted waters of recounts and court battles. We all remember this too well from 2000. And what ultimately happened in Florida in Bush versus Gore is it was fights over recounts that the Supreme Court put a stop to because it was time for the Electoral College to come together and meet. And what they reaffirmed in Bush versus Gore is that under conditions like this, these state legislatures have the right to name electors. You could conceivably, in the kind of nightmare scenario, imagine that these gerrymandered legislatures send electors that are different than those that it's clear the people of that state voted for.
What if that were to happen? It would require a certain alignment of Republican control at state legislatures to come together to make it happen. And Republicans have quite smartly, of course, laid the groundwork for state-controlled legislatures for years now, and they've been fairly successful at it. So where are the hot spots that we should be looking out for?
I think it's Michigan, it's Pennsylvania, and it is Wisconsin. Those are the three key states where the legislatures have been gerrymandered in such a way as to lock in Republican control over the course of this entire decade, even when Democrats win more votes. They are swing states, and they are states that are not going to allow for the votes to be tabulated until after until after Election Day itself begins. So if there is going to be a perfect storm, it's going to be in those three states.
If the Republican Party wanted to hold on to political power, there's two ways to do it. They could certainly try to increase the turnout of Republican voters. It's called get out the vote. It's something everybody in this country is legitimately encouraged to do, so to encourage everybody to go and vote. It could also enable or enact policies or back policies that are more popular, but it doesn't seem to be doing very much of that. There is a news piece, the New York Times on Monday reported that there were some gains in voter registration that Republicans were making, doing quite well in certain states, Florida, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. That's a legitimate task for any party to register their voters to vote, right? It's certainly not worthy of criticism. In fact, it should be praised.
Absolutely. What I would say is that Republicans had a crossroads that they stood at several years ago. And this was after the 2012 election when they had lost the popular vote for the fifth of the last six presidential elections, Republicans commissioned what became known as the autopsy. They tried to figure out where the party should go from here. And they did research, and they talked to, you know, thousands of political professionals, and they did polling and focus groups. And what came back is that Americans saw them as a party of stuffy old men. Communities of color didn't believe that Republicans wanted them in the country. They decided they needed to come up with a message for millennials, for the LGBTQ community. They needed to come up with a plan on immigration reform. Republicans weren't able to do any of these things because they had instead embarked on this strategy of redistricting, of gerrymandering, of voter suppression, and rule rigging. And what that did is it created a different kind of Republican Party. It created a different caucus. When you draw such uncompetitive districts, the only action is in the Republican primary. So you end up with members who are far more ideological, and they are unwilling to compromise on anything because the only election they fear is a primary. So after the Supreme Court in the Shelby County case, Congressman Sensenbrenner gets together with John Lewis and John Boehner, he told me, and they tried to come up with language in Congress that would have essentially put Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act back in place. And Sensenbrenner essentially got booed out of his own caucus. He and other members who were no longer there told me that it was made clear to Republicans that they would face a primary challenge if they got behind Voting Rights Act and if they pushed this. And as a result, it fell apart. And here we are in this mess.
You also interviewed former Republican National Committee Chair Michael Steele. It's rare for an African-American Republican in a position of power. What did Michael Steele tell you? And, you know, I imagine for him, the issue of voting rights is personal.
Yeah, I think this was very painful for him. I really enjoyed the conversation. I found him to be honest and candid. He essentially admitted that what the party had done was they had, you know, stopped talking to all Americans, and they doubled down on this racist voter suppression strategy. And I think he's horrified by it now. I talked with a number of Republicans to Bill Kristol, to, you know, a former South Carolina conservative, Bob Inglis, and they all ached as they sort of talked about how their party had created what they call the new American apartheid through their efforts on gerrymandering and voter suppression. And I think this is the kind of conversation that is going to happen on the Republican side for anything to really change. We have seen that the Democrats have become much more outspoken on democracy issues and voting rights. But for genuine change, for us to get back to a place where these are seen as American values, it's going to take change inside the Republican Party, and that's going to take a lot of time, I fear.
So when you were writing this piece and speaking with some of these Republicans who have now, you know, looked back on their time, on where the party has come, did you find that there was any ownership that they might have taken for what has transpired? Because you say, you know, it's not like Trump invented this or ushered in this idea for permanent minority rule. You say he just swept up the pieces. Did any of the Republican officials admit that they went down the wrong path?
They are very cautious about that, you know? And I'd say this, the number of Republicans who refused to talk to me, who would not pick up the phone and turn down interview requests, include John Boehner, include Paul Ryan, include Eric Cantor, you know, include a lot of prominent people who are still publicly unwilling to reckon with what they created and the Frankenstein's monster that they turned loose on our politics. So I give a lot of credit to those Republicans who are courageous and candid enough to at least come this far. Yeah, I think that some of them do understand this, because you can't look at the timeline and say, well, Donald Trump created this. You know, Donald Trump doesn't come down that escalator at Trump Tower until summer of 2015. The Republican redistricting efforts are happening in 2009, in 2010. Shelby County is being decided in 2013. The monster voter suppression bills are being passed in North Carolina and in Texas, in all of these states, way before Donald Trump announces his plans for the presidency. This is on the Republican Party. It's not on Donald Trump.
So finally, it comes down to these three states as we look to November 3rd and the days and weeks following that: Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And you, as a Californian, it's always deeply distressing that the most populous state in the nation appears to have no bearing whatsoever on the decision making around who becomes president. So these three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, are you seeing through the trends and the news reports around early voting that there might be some cautious optimism, because it's, you were alluding to the fact that if there's enough Democratic turnout to overwhelm the Republican votes, then that can inure itself from and can, you know, keep the, protect the election's integrity.
Yeah. Election administrators have a prayer. They say, "Dear Lord, please don't let it be close." And I think that that's the kind of prayer that all of us who are concerned about American representative democracy ought to be whispering to ourselves over the course of these next 15 days. If this is a close election, it's going to end up in the courts, and our system is perhaps not prepared for the kind of chaos that could follow. This is a system that has been governed really more by norms than by actual written laws. And as we have seen, norms aren't holding up very well these days. Let's hope we don't have to rely on them for a peaceful transfer of power.
Well, David, we will link to your article from our website. I thank you so much for joining us today and helping us put a context to what we're seeing play out before us. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
David Daley is my guest. He's a journalist whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Slate, The Washington Post, New York Magazine, and The New Republic. He's a senior fellow at Fairvote, former editor of Salon, and his books include Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, and Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. We've just been discussing his latest piece in The New Republic. It's entitled Inside: The Republican Plot for Permanent Minority Rule. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.